from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Picture, if you will, a city of about 300,000 people, something the size of Tampa, Florida, or Riverside, California. Now picture all of those people in this city being told the city is being closed down and they have to move. That's what the Kenyan government in East Africa is trying to do with the 340,000 people who live in Dadaab, the world's largest refugee camp. Located in northeastern Kenya near the border of Somalia, Dadaab was built by the UN 24 years ago to house people fleeing Somalia's civil war. A quarter century later, Somalia is still an extremely poor and volatile place. Many people in Dadaab don't want to go back, but Kenya's government has had enough of hosting them. It says some terror attacks on Kenya were planned inside the camp by Somalis loyal to the militant group Al-Shabaab. That includes the one on a Kenyan school in the town of Garissa last year that killed 148 students. On this edition of Global Journalist, we're going to talk about the difficulties involved in closing an enormous refugee camp. We've got three great guests joining us now. From Mogadishu, Somalia, is a human rights lawyer, Anab Noor. From Washington, D.C., John Thon Majok. He's at the Wilson Center, and he spent 12 years living as a refugee in Kenya and Ethiopia. Mark Yarnell is joining us from near Ottawa in Canada. He's a senior advocate at Refugees International. Welcome to all of you. Anab Noor, you're in Mogadishu right now. One of the key issues in closing this camp across the border in Kenya is how ready Somalia itself is to host these 300,000 people coming back. What can you tell us about the security situation there right now?
Well, I think I don't think that the Somali government is currently ready to absorb such a large number of people. There is the security situation here is extremely fragile. The government only controls certain pockets in Somalia, and it's a new government. It requires a lot of help. If we take Mogadishu, for example, where I'm currently at, the government-controlled areas have experienced a number of complex attacks by al-Shabaab in the last 3-4 years that I've been here. And it's been on the increase. Assassinations have been on the increase. I think security-wise, it's, you know, the security situation here is extremely fragile. It hasn't improved. And I think it will take a long time before this government, and after the 2016 election, the next government is able to secure Somalia in a much better way. You have situations where AMISOM and government soldiers have been able to take
AMISOM is the UN peacekeeping force in Somalia now.
Yes, that's correct. You know, made of neighboring countries like Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and others. So they've liberated certain areas, but the problem is once they've liberated those areas from al-Shabaab, there is no competent authority to take over. So there's a bit of a, you know, a gap, a hole, and it's a well-known fact that, the al-Shabaab are able to return and take control over certain areas. An example of this is Lower Shabelle, where over a number of times there've been AMISOM and government soldiers taking over and then al-Shabaab taking back over and so forth. So the security situation in Somalia is not ready. But in any case, we also have other issues such as, the government is it's relatively new after more than 20 years of civil war. There is no adequate resources available here.
I want to turn to some of those other issues momentarily here, but it sounds like the security situation itself is sort of the first step, and it sounds like the country itself is quite unstable. So let me turn this to Mark Yarnell with Refugees International. What can you tell us about what the Kenyan government's motivations are in wanting to close this gigantic refugee camp?
When Kenya made the announcement in early May of this year, the primary rationale for closing the camp was because of concerns around security within Kenya. There were also issues cited to the economic impact of hosting refugees as well as the long-term impact on the environmental degradation around the Dadaab area where the camp is located. But certainly the focus has been on security, on the Somali population. Interestingly, when the announcement was first made, the government also said they wanted to shut down the Kakuma camp, which predominantly hosts South Sudanese refugees. But the government, after some backlash, backed away from that threat and are now focusing on just returning Somalis and having them leave Kenya.
And John Tom Majak, I'd like to bring you into the conversation now because you have lived in one of these refugee camps in Kenya for a large portion of your life. As someone who has been through this experience, give us just a sense of what it's like to live in a refugee camp. Do you live like an ordinary Kenyan would while you're in Kenya?
No. And first, I want to thank the people of Kenya because they have hosted me and my colleagues from South Sudan for almost a decade. For me, it's almost a decade. For the rest, it's more than that. They are compassionate people. They are hospitable. But this decision by the government to close the world's largest refugee camp will endanger the lives of vulnerable women, children, and the elderly. Having lived in the refugee camps for a good chunk of my life, it is not a life that you dream for, living in the refugee camp. That's not a dream life. It's a survival life. But the refugees are narrowed to only this choice because of the prevailing situation in their countries of origin. In this case, the case of Somalia, we just heard that it is unsafe for them to return. While the refugee life is not a normal life, that is the only choice they have. So it's protect the lives at the moment in that camp, and closing it will just put their life back to danger. And I hope the Kenyan people will understand that they have been a safe haven for several decades for the neighboring country refugees, South Sudan, Sudan, Ethiopia, Uganda, you name it. Kenya was the only hope for those. But I think it's jeopardizing a reputation now by doing that. I hope they reconsider.
Well, let me turn this to Anab Noor back in Mogadishu. You had been speaking earlier about the security situation in Somalia. You said it was still volatile. The government forces in the UN would take a portion of territory. Some weeks would pass and al-Shabaab would come back and take it back. But it is the case that Somalia is more stable than it was several years ago. So given that, what are some of the other challenges that refugees might face if they are pushed out of this camp?
Well, I think the problem that we will face here is it would destabilize what little peace efforts the government has been able to achieve in Somalia. We're looking at 300,000, 340,000 people being returned. And I think that would definitely destabilize Somalia. There are no adequate resources. The government is unable to provide any sort of social services support of any kind. There's no social infrastructure. There's no housing. There'd be no benefits for them. And a lot of these people, if they were to be forcibly returned to Somalia, would probably end up as IDPs. I mean, Somalia is, Somalia has 1.1 million displaced people within Somalia, and currently you have almost 400,000 in Mogadishu and on the outskirts of Mogadishu. So we know the circumstances under which they live. So I think to return such a large number of people to Somalia, we'll just be looking at a much bigger crisis. The other thing is, the majority of refugees currently, I think more than half of the refugees in Dadaab are currently under the age of 18. And I think they would be more susceptible. I think it would pose more security risks, both for Somalia and for Kenya, if they were to return.
And Mark Yarnell, you mentioned earlier that the Kenyan government has cited internal security as one of their main reasons for doing this. And we talked about some of the terror attacks that have taken place in Kenya in recent years, which have been really horrific, both at the Westgate Mall and at the Garissa School. What evidence is there that people from the camp were involved in either planning or participating in these attacks? Is this a fact and an evidence-based argument?
I mean, it's a great question, and Kenya certainly faces real security threats and challenges. But from our side, we have not seen any evidence that the attacks were planned out of the camp or are linked to refugees themselves. I mean, it's so important to understand that refugees, they become refugees because they're fleeing insecurity and difficult problems in their host country, in their home country. And so they're people who are fleeing violence and fleeing terrorism. And so to now put the blame on them for security threats within Kenya, I think is sort of they're being victimized additionally. And I think we talked a bit before about the stated rationale for Kenya to close the camp. I think in reality, the announcement to close the Dadaab came shortly after President Kenyatta, the president of Kenya, announced his bid for re-election. I think there's some politics involved. And there's also been direct pointing by the Kenyan government to the deal that Turkey made with the European Union to prevent refugees leaving Turkey to go to EU. And I think Kenya's interested to see that what they can potentially gain from that. So there's a lot more at play than just the stated.
So I'm sorry, and in that deal, Turkey received something like $3.4 billion from the European Union to sort of staunch the flow of migrants and refugees through right. Turkish territory and even to take people back from Europe. Is that the case?
Yeah, and estimates are it's even higher than that. But yeah, several billion dollars direct payment to the Turkish government.
And so you think this may be something of a negotiating ploy potentially by the Kenyan government to get more funding?
I think that's part of it. But at the same time, plans are moving ahead. And as we're seeing, people are being returned to from Kenya to Somalia, and it's being termed voluntary. But certainly from interviews of people who are leaving the camp, many of them say they're leaving because they don't want to face a forced push down the road. And so it's sort of to call this voluntary, I think, is a bit of a sham.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, we're talking about the effort to close the world's largest refugee camp in Kenya and what may become of the 340,000 mostly Somalis who live there. We're talking to Mark Yarnell of Refugees International, Jonathan Majok of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and Anab Noor, a human rights lawyer in Mogadishu, Somalia. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read our ongoing series of interviews with journalists in exile around the world and coverage of foreign affairs. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Jern. Jonathan Majok, I wanted to ask you about how the decision is made to return a refugee to their home country. If the country is no longer in sort of a state of civil war, if the refugees, like the threat of them being shot and killed, is not there, is it enough that they can just go back to an extremely poor place with no resources? Or is there an expectation that their home country will also have things like schools and safe drinking water and other things which may not exist in many parts of Somalia now?
Well, under international law, the three durable solutions are reintegration into the local society, resettlement in the third country, and voluntary return or repatriation to a country of origin. So under that, the UNHCR Charter and the UN Convention, the conditions for voluntary repatriation include that it must be voluntary by the refugee to go there. And so the refugee must be well informed. The other condition is that the country of origin must be safe for return.
So in other words, then, if the condition is that the refugee themselves must be voluntary, the refugee can also make the decision based on their well-being in the camp on economic factors and say, well, here we've got safe drinking water, here we've got schools, we may be living a survival life, as you termed it, but it's still better than going back and starting with nothing in a place like southern Somalia or South Sudan.
I don't think any say individual decision, but I don't think anyone would, any individual would prefer to live in a refugee camp than to live in his or her home, because there's no place like home. But having lived in the refugee camp is not always a dream life. That's not the choice you can make in life, that your people, your children will live there. So there are always these push factors that force the refugee to stay there. But if there are options, for example, in the case of Kenya now, these refugees have been living for more than 24 years in the camp. But the Kenyan law does not integrate refugee in the society to become citizen. So it's one of the things that can help Kenya rethinking that law.
So in other words, they can't go out and get a job elsewhere in Kenya outside the camp.
Exactly. You become citizen, you can be integrated formally and you can get employment outside the camp. But right now they are restricted to the refugee camp, and that is that protracted encampment of refugees with their talent. But integration can just unleash them. And I think that could help Kenya in terms of being productive members of the society and help them with resolving this issue. The country of origin, too, has a responsibility to make sure they prepare the condition for a safe return for their citizens.
Well, Anab Noor, let me turn that to you then, because John Tharmajok did raise one interesting issue. Given the fact that this camp has been open for 24 years, there are people who have been born there and literally lived their entire lives within a refugee camp. So how well prepared will they be to integrate back into Somalia? Will people in Somalia view them even as their own countrymen?
I think that's definitely a very interesting question, Jason. Identity has always been of great interest to me. I myself was once a refugee in the UK and was able to naturalize and become a British citizen at one point. As you said, the majority, I think, of refugees currently in Dadaab are those born inside the camp, or those who had to flee from Somalia from a very young age. So they may not necessarily identify themselves as Somalis, having spent such a great number of years there. I think in Somalia, because of the civil war and because so many people have had to flee to so many different countries all over the world, as long as your origin is Somali, you'll probably most likely be accepted. But it's a question of, you know, it's culturally, it's different. It'll take some time getting used to it. So I don't think that everybody will identify Somalia as their home, especially those that were born and raised in Dadaab.
And Mark Yarnell, let me turn it to you, because I was also hoping you'd pick up on something that John Tharmajok said. And he was arguing that the Kenyan government should grant greater rights to the people in the camp to integrate into Kenya itself. But obviously that seems like a political non-starter right now. But it also raises the question as to why Kenya should be shouldering so much of the responsibility, given sort of the scope of the problem in Somalia. Is it fair to ask them to do that?
Well, it's an important point because, as John mentioned in his initial remarks, Kenya has been, and he's experienced himself, a generous host to refugees for decades. And also John mentioned that there are three main durable solutions: returning to your home country, integrating locally into your host country, or being resettled to a third country. And I think what's remarkable is annually less than 1% of the world's refugees are resettled to third countries, and that's shocking, and it's devastating. I think how limited that is, and so when only 1% are resettled, then that gives such a limited option to so many other people. So I think it's an important question for Kenya to be raising, that other countries should be doing their part as well to be hosts to people who can't go back to their home countries.
And John Tharmajok, I wanted to ask you about sort of the broader political climate right now, especially in the U.S. and Europe, Australia, elsewhere. There's a very strong anti-immigrant sentiment that has been on the rise. Donald Trump spoke recently of temporarily banning immigration from places like Somalia, and in the future doing extreme vetting of would-be immigrants. What does this sort of political phenomenon and feeling in the U.S. and other Western countries, what does that mean for these hundreds of thousands of refugees in East Africa?
That's a great question. And having been a refugee, I think putting myself into their shoes, those who have been living in the camps and see all this political rhetoric, feel abandoned by the international community that is supposed to protect them. And I came here through the resettlement, the U.S. resettlement program. And I went through an intensive security background check. It took me almost 2 years to come here. So the rhetoric like this is what the Kenyan government is also buying, because if the security is a concern in Europe and the American politicians are buying into this, that's what Kenya is saying. That legitimizes their argument that we have a security concern too at our borders, and therefore we are returning them. If we know under international law, vulnerable people, refugees, are to be protected, the international community has a responsibility, as well as the host country like Kenya, a responsibility to provide. Currently, there is a shortfall in budget, and I think have donors, the international donors, the UN agencies, have they met their, the other countries, have they met their budget goals? Because this is the responsibility to provide to the vulnerable people like refugees.
And Anab Noor, John was just talking on these budget issues that the UN is facing in keeping this camp open inside Somalia. And you raised an interesting point when you were saying that many of these people, if they're sent back to Somalia, they'll become internally displaced people. Effectively, they'll be refugees in their own country. You said there are 400,000 on the outskirts of Mogadishu right now. Southern Somalia only has 5 or 6 million people in it. So if you had 300,000 refugees, that's a huge number of people coming in, potentially just living in effectively tents on the outskirts of the city. So does the Somali government, what's their posture? Does it want these people to come back now, or is it sort of happy for them to stay in Kenya if that's possible?
I think the line that the government has been taking is they've been saying that they'd be, you know, they'd be welcoming, they'd be quite happy to for people to return to Somalia as long as it's on a voluntary basis. But I think that's very unrealistic. I just don't see how that such a large number of people can be absorbed into Somalia. I think if anything, it will destabilize what little, you know, peace there appears to be at the moment. I think it's something that it's probably will take a very long time. You'll note that a lot of the people that have been coming back have been of different diversity groups. I mean, currently you have a lot of diasporas like myself returning to Somalia for various different reasons. But, you know, obviously we're not in the same categories as refugees. And I think that's sort of the mistake that a lot of people make by saying, well, look, you've got X amount of people going back. Why can't these people go back? And that comes down to resources, again, because the government is incapable and cannot, you know, they can't offer them the protection that's necessary. They can't afford to offer them the resources that's necessary. So I think that's, I can see that this is something that Kenya is very keen to do, but it has to be done properly. It has to be done legally, and it has to take, you know, it's something that's going to take a long period of time. I mean, these people have been in Kenya for the past 24 years. It's not, it's you know, it's not something that's going to be solved overnight. If you don't mind, I just also wanted to touch very briefly on some of the other things that have been said so far. Kenya, and I think also globally, have been associating or citing security as one of the reasons which I you know, and I think it's very unfair and very discriminatory to you know, to accuse refugees of having a foot in terrorism. And I think, you know, there's no evidence, as Marcus said before, that, you know, the terrorism-related, there's been no terrorism-related charges brought against any refugees, as far as I'm aware. And that just comes down to sort of a poor security management in Kenya. But I think it's a very dangerous narrative globally, and it's not evidence-based at all to start linking refugees to terrorism and security issues. I think that's extremely dangerous and very unfair, considering how vulnerable they are.
And Mark Yarnell, I wanted to ask you as well. You had talked earlier about some of the difficulties involved, the logistical difficulties of getting people back to Somalia. And there was an excellent story in the Kenyan newspaper, The Daily Nation, recently about a teenage girl that had come to Dadaab by foot from Somalia at 13, had never been to school a day in her life. Once she became a refugee at the camp, she got sent to high school. She began to learn to read and write, gain all these skills. She and her family recently went back to Somalia as part of this voluntary repatriation program. And when she got there, there was no school, there was no job. And so her father tried to marry her off to a 50-year-old man, and she ended up walking back to Kenya, to the refugee camp, but she's no longer considered a refugee and can't get any services. So to what extent is this creating maybe more problems than it potentially is solving?
is extremely critical point, because there are indications, in addition to this, I think, extremely tragic story you just described, there are many people like her who are taking a return package to return to Somalia to try to reintegrate to life there, but are finding either the threats too great, or they end up back in IDP camps, as you mentioned, and then decide to come back to Kenya. And now, if you accept that reality and re-register them and provide support, then that's one thing. But if now the plan is, okay, we're just going to shut down the refugee camp, people are just going to do what they can to make it on their own. They may not go back to Somalia, but they'll live illegally in Kenya. They might move to Uganda to try to make a life there. The Somali population is very transnational and mobile, and will do what they have to do to survive. And either you can accept that reality and work with it and support it, or you can say, we're just going to shut the camp down, and then you end up with people kind of scattered, living underground without having legal status.
And John Thaumajok, our time does grow short, but I want to ask you about potential solution for this problem, because it seems almost intractable in a way. These people have been in these camps for 24 years, and given some of all the political challenges that we've discussed on this show, it doesn't seem like closing the camp is a very good option. It seems like, in a way, there's been this decision to sort of keep these camps open for decades, even if it means having refugees warehouses. Is that sort of the long-term viable solution here?
There are several. One in this situation is integration. Kenya should rethink its integration law and make sure they integrate refugees into their society. For example, those who were born there, if Kenya accept refugees to be citizens, they would be Kenyan citizens by now. So that's one. Number two, another possible is resettlement. So the third countries in the Western world should try to increase the resettlement percentage in terms of who will be resettled from the Dadaab refugee camp and others. And that's another possible area where negotiation is. The third is if it's not possible at all for the Kenyan government to keep that camp open, then the other option would be to relocate the refugees to other countries or other part of Kenya if the Kenyan government believes that it is the Dadaab, because it's close to the Somalia border.
I'm sorry, John, we're out of time. We're going to have to end it there for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Many thanks to Mark Yarnell, John Thaumajok, and Anab Noor for joining us. Our producers this week are Jinhong Chen and Shavila Raskaskate. Travis McMillan of RJI is our director. Pat Akers of KBIA is our audio engineer. This week we bid farewell to our executive producer, Joshua Kranzberg, whose work has enlivened the video you see on our YouTube channel. We'll also miss his expertise at corralling guests from Beijing to Bogota and many of the places in between. For all of us at Global Journalist, thank you, Josh, and thanks for tuning in.